Okay, second section, global geopolitics. I warned in the annual wrap-up, as I have for many years, that our greatest danger is not the risk of global financial collapse. Our greatest risk is war, because the reason we haven't had a financial collapse is the slow burn is engineered, and the thing that keeps the slow burn working is force. And when covert force doesn't work, we get overt force in the nature of war. What's happening is very simple. I keep telling the story of Jimmy Rogers at the New Orleans Gold Conference. Somebody asked him if he was worried about peak oil. He said, forget peak oil, it's peak everything. We're watching stress of growing populations engaged in greater consumption. The models that we're using for the financial system and investment are designed for control, not to create the incentives to live in harmony with the environment. If you look at the proposals to shift us to a model of carbon tax and things like it, it's a very top-down controlled model. It's not a model that's going to work. It's going to be very ugly. They're wonderful models. They're ways of doing it that are bottom-up and create the incentives in the markets to allow people to, to reinvent how we do it. The problem with those models is that they don't guarantee that the people who are in control now will remain in control. Control or leadership and governance will be much more driven by meritocracy. Anyway, so we're watching the stress of growing populations in the face of harsh weather, environmental risks, and ongoing disaster capitalism. And the use of force is increasing, and that raises risks throughout the global economy. And there's no greater example than our first section, grain, gas, pipelines, debt, the dance in the Ukraine. We've put up a tremendous amount of commentaries and stories on what's going on in the Ukraine to the extent we know it. You have America and Europe and various American and European corporations in the Ukraine as the price of wheat and gas rise. You have more and more sort of corporate interests moving, and you have the Ukraine is one of the greatest bread baskets in the world, and of course they're the transmission point for much gas, much pipelines, and it's all part of the grand chessboard Eurasia issue that has been with us now for years. And so Ukraine is, there's no doubt, a plum, and as I've said on previous Solari reports, Ukraine is a plum which really hasn't managed itself well. Their per capita income has remained at the same levels that they were in the early 90s, whereas Russia and Poland have, and other areas around them, have improved dramatically. They've stayed sort of flat. And in these situations, you get a dynamic of use it or lose it. When you have America and Europe promoting NATO, trying to get the Ukraine into the European Union, you really create enormous insecurity in Russia. It's a little bit like having the Russians down in Cuba messing around. We're playing somewhat in their playpen. Now, if you look at the tensions between the Ukraine, with the exception of some of the Russian populations, and Russia, those are plenty. So the opportunities for divide and conquer are absolutely enormous. And at this point, you just have too many powerful forces, all the money in the planet, working and dividing and conquering and playing all sorts of games. So I won't bore you with all the details. But what we're seeing is, as part of the fight, is more and more sanctions flying back and forth between the United States, Russia, and the European Union. And all of these things are negative on the economy. This kind of fighting is very negative on the economy. And so we're really pushing a very deflationary kind of process. If you look behind the scenes, I'm not convinced what's happening is so much a battle between sovereign nations, is a battle between sort of which corporations are going to get to cut up the pie. And I think if you look at the Russians, from what I know of them and what I can intuit through between the lines, is for them this is much more about whether they're going to be a sovereign nation or whether they're going to get picked over the way they were in the 90s. Not to say that they haven't picked over the Ukraine, including what happened at Chernobyl. So you had the rape of Russia in the 90s, and I've posted some things about that. Obviously, World War II, they lost 27 million people. So the Russians have gotten rolled on many occasions. And I think Putin has done everything he can to rebuild from the rape of Russia in the 90s. And this is not just about the economy or national interests. This is about governance models. Russia wants to be a sovereign nation. It wants to run itself. It wants to be able to protect its immediate interests, whether it's access to the Black Sea or, you know, protect Russians in the Crimea. So these are all sort of sovereign interests, and Russia has made it very clear, Putin has made it very clear, he does not want Russia to be run by corporations. So I think you're seeing a fairly deep struggle in values, one between a nation that does not want to be corporations, does not want to have, you know, GMO seed dictated to it, does not want to have NSA listening to everything. They're thinking very much in terms of, we want to, you know, we want to be a sovereign nation, and we want the individuals within us to have certain rights of sovereignty. So this is a deeper struggle. One of the subscribers asked, is this a squabble between the Russians and the Rothschilds? I wouldn't so much say the Rothschilds, because it gets back to who's in control. The question is, does Russia determine what goes on in Russia, or do a group of corporations and invasive surveillance technology determine what's going on in Russia? So there's a real sort of struggle in terms of sovereignty, which is why I think some of the sanctions are going to boomerang, and you're literally watching a competition between two groups who have very different values. Right in the middle of it, we have the IMF making big loans. That money's not going to the Ukraine. It's going back to hedge funds and banks, both in Russia and Europe and probably in the United States. The one thing I think that is sort of the lesson coming out of this is I see more and more people beginning to understand the tactic of soft revolutions and soft weapons. Charles Smith is going to be joining us a week after next to talk about soft weapons, because I think it's very, very important to understand the kind of tactics that the people who control the telecommunication systems and can deliver entrainment can affect, how they can affect a population and sort of the weapons they have to use. I also think you're seeing a growing backlash. The frustration that was going to be expressed in the elections here is the same frustration you're seeing around the world of people and nations who are sick of the invasiveness. And unfortunately, we see too much of the leadership is what I call blinded by the beauty of their weapons. And I think they underestimate the risk and the dangers of these backlashes. It doesn't have to, you know, the tactics that I think they're using are increasingly wasteful, and the backlash is increasingly tense. We see, unfortunately, NASA announced this week the cooperation with the Russians in space is off. It doesn't surprise me if the Americans are using this as an excuse to really leave themselves much freer to proceed with space-based weapons. Finally, of course, we see G8 downsizing to G7 as part of this dance. A lot happening just this week, and so I think this is a very fluid story. Could this get very bad? Yes, it could get very bad. One of the stories I posted up on the blog in the Dance in Ukraine section is an amazing story entitled U.S. Secretly Built Cuban Twitter to Stir Unrest. Great background if you want to understand the soft revolution and soft weapon issue, and I recommend it to you. It was interesting, during the initial couple weeks of problems in the Ukraine, we saw in Putin, the Russians sort of moving into the Crimea, I would get so many emails saying, oh, well, you know, the United States is weak and Russia's, you know, there's sort of lots of games trying to position people in sort of cheap emotional ways. And the dollar's going down. And so I put up the charts of the S&P versus the Russian market and the emerging market, as well as the S&P versus wheat and natural gas during the period. And I would encourage you, whenever you're watching stories like this, to always watch the charts, because the charts will always tell you, or often tell you, a very different story than when you're, what you're sort of hearing is the spin, whether it's in the corporate media and the alternative media. And I, for one, I have a lot of faith in price, no matter how manipulated it is to talk about what's going on. So take a look at those, because it's always interesting to see. One of the things you're seeing is the price of wheat and natural gas goes up, the fight gets worse. Next section under geopolitics, the quiet dread of Fukushima. I think that what is happening at Fukushima is unbelievably important. I continue to do everything I can to try and ascertain what's happening and what it means. I think the unanswered questions only grow. We've watched Japan engage in massive monetary expansion, and of course their stock market was up tremendously last year. I put up the chart of Tokyo Electric Power versus the Japanese ETF, and what you can see, of course, is Tokyo Power is down more than 80%, but of course it doesn't go down all the way. Tokyo needs its electric utility, so clearly the government is continues to support it. But I did want to point out, we had a great interview with Don Cox during the first quarter, and he offered in sort of a much more positive alternative view on Japan, which is, if you're interested, I would really encourage you to do. I will continue to try and find answers to the unanswered questions of Fukushima, but for now they just grow. And I would continue to ask that we continue to pray for all concerned. I think this is an issue that is so important, so serious, it calls for prayer. Reform and slowdown in China and the emerging markets. There's no doubt that Chinese growth for many years has depended on enormous leverage in local municipalities, in the shadow banking system, and massive subsidies of various kinds. And clearly that had to come to an end. The corruption in China has become just very significant and a real danger to their long-term economic growth. So we see reform of the Chinese shadow banking system. Don't be surprised if we see a deposit scheme, government deposit guarantee come out that will sort of help build the regular banks, which will of course emerge as the largest in the world. But it means much slower growth in China, and that means much slower growth in the emerging markets. So if Europe is not buying from China, then China is not buying from Brazil, and so it goes around in a circle. And of course, as we talked a lot last year and in the wrap-up, G7 continues to call the capital homeward. I put up a chart of the emerging market ETF versus the S&P 500. One of the things I was eager to see is, would the emerging markets turn up? No, they continue down. From the beginning of the year, they were down about 5%. Now, they started to turn up, but we'll see if it holds. We continue to see enormous divergence between the developed markets and emerging markets. And, of course, the day that turns, or the time that turns, it could be a very significant shift, because now you're paying a price-earnings ratio for earnings in the developed markets that's way above what you're paying in the emerging markets. Energy breakthroughs. And I put this in global geopolitics because energy is something that impacts everything, and it impacts everybody everywhere, not to mention the fact that, the reserve currency is on a petrodollar standard. We see renewables growing in very sort of yeasty organic ways, lots of different kinds of renewables. The clear direction in the developed world is let's do some everything and see how it goes. Fracking continues to move to Europe with this battle with Russia. That's going to increase the pressure on Europe to say yes to fracking. One of the most important developments for renewables is the battery. I put up a picture of a mock-up of the new Tesla Gigafactory? The mega factory that Tesla is planning. a lot of what they're doing is work, sort of breakthrough work in battery. If the battery solution gets solved, what it means is wind, solar, all the different renewables get much more competitive. So creative destruction is already on us, whether it's what's actually happening in renewables or what's threatened with other breakthrough technology or just the fear of investors that it's coming. We see real struggling in the utilities and other areas, and of course more running to the statehouse and the capital of the countries trying to get protection to keep their sort of 2.0 model going. So this is going to be a very dynamic area. One of the funniest things going on is around the world you have many different inventors working on many different technologies, all of whom are convinced that their technology will rock the world. And what is not understood is getting something out of the lab into a workable both business model and consumer model is much harder than any inventor can imagine. And so translating something from an invention to a business is a big step. And then, of course, you have many, many inventors at the same time. So this is going to be a very creative area, and the politics are going to be intense. And, of course, I don't think you're going to see adaption of very significant breakthrough technology until or unless the question of what is the reserve currency and what standard is on gets sorted out as part of a process, because this is not just an energy question, it's a currency question. Another big question is how will energy work with the Internet of Things? We know Tesla felt that energy could be delivered through things like wireless technology, so the question is, will that happen? I put up a chart of one of the solar ETFs. We've seen the solar and many of the renewable stocks really bubble. And these stocks have traded way ahead of the market, and many of us would argue way beyond their real economic value. So one of the questions is there a real bubble happening here? But it's you'll see it's way ahead of the regular market indices. And maybe some of it is just people saying, you know, we've had it with 2.0. We went 3.0 now, so we're going to put our money in that sort of you go jump in the lake investment decision.